From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Sarah Augustine is the co-founder and executive director of the Coalition to Dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery. Thank you so much, Sarah, for being on the Oregon Grapevine.
So grateful to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with the basic, what is the Doctrine of Discovery?
So the Doctrine of Discovery is a body of law and policy that was adopted by the Supreme Court in the United States in 1823. So this discovery doctrine, it's a legal doctrine. It frames reality in the United States for Indigenous peoples to this day and for everyone else, because it determines who has the right to own and control land. So the discovery doctrine, as it was originally conceived of by the Holy Roman Empire during the time of European expansion to the world, that doctrine dictated that any land that was not governed by a Christian monarch was free and open for the taking. So any Christian monarch could take over that land and have ultimate sovereignty if they were the first to arrive. So they would arrive, plant their flag, claim dominion over that land, and if there were people that were there, and of course everywhere there were already people, those people did not count as they didn't count as being sovereign, because they weren't part of Christendom. That was the idea. And so many people today call this the Christian doctrine of discovery when they're talking about that plan of expansion that was instituted by the Holy Roman Empire. But in our coalition, we're really referring to the discovery doctrine, which is a legal doctrine implemented into our legal canon in 1823. And our coalition is dedicated to dismantling it. And that's not a metaphor. We mean to dismantle that body of law and policy.
This is a deep and complicated question, but how do you do that? How do you go about deciding and really implementing the dismantling of this document and the codes of law?
Sure. So I want to begin by just saying, sorry to be tedious here, it's not a document. It's a body of policy that's been in place for hundreds of years. So it's much more than just one document. And so let's think about this in another sort of legal doctrine that we're maybe familiar with in this country. And that would be the legal doctrine to justify slavery. There was a legal doctrine that explained why slavery was legal. And it was justified with theology, but actually that doctrine, which is embedded into our Constitution, explained in a legal framework how slavery was going to work in the legislature. And that doctrine is expressed in our Constitution, but not just in the Constitution, right? There are hundreds of laws then based upon that original framework for how slavery is going to work. And that's our legal structure. It's a precedence structure. So something that's a little more recent would be then the segregation doctrine. How is segregation going to work in the United States? So that framework was laid out by the Supreme Court in a series of decisions, and then was implemented at the local, the state, and the federal level through many hundreds of laws over a period of time. And that's what the discovery doctrine is too. It was adopted in a series of Supreme Court decisions, the Marshall decisions in 1823. This is really during the settlement and the westward expansion of the United States. And it really explains that the United States is going to participate in this international framework for how settlement will occur, where the federal government then has dominion over all of the land, and that Indigenous people are subordinate to that dominion. And in fact, Indigenous people, while they may have the right of occupancy, in other words, you know, by 1823, may be allowed to live, but at the pleasure of the federal government. So that means they can be moved around. Indigenous people don't have sovereignty. We don't have control of our own lands or our own destiny. And so that framework remains in place in the United States today and is the basis not only for the way land is conceived of in context of Indigenous peoples, but also in private property and the benefits that are gained by this for people who are settler descended. So if we think about segregation as a framework, what did it take to dismantle segregation? One thing to note is it didn't happen in one election cycle.
So is part of your strategy or part of your work then to go state by state or municipality by municipality and kind of look at the codes, or how do you, you, it's there and it's everywhere and it's kind of a tentacle, an octopus as it were. Mm-hmm. What, as you look at that, it I imagine can feel overwhelming. Where do you start and what do you do?
Well, we have a 100-year strategy, which is probably explaining that as probably beyond the scope of our time together. But I will tell you that we are certainly working on campaigns locally at the state level and in networks across the United States and also in Canada, because Canada, of course, is also defined by this discovery doctrine. And it's also been affirmed into their legal structure as well. And so from my point of view, the tactics that you use to do a big project like this change over time from generation to generation. We are, in our coalition, we are a movement and not an organization. So we're working with volunteers and activists all across the United States and other places too, Canada, Mexico, across North America, but also in other areas as well. And what we are doing is we are laying the groundwork now for the next generation, for the work of the next generation. So if we think about this in terms of what happened to abolish slavery, this, which was also an international movement to abolish slavery, it didn't begin and end in the United States, it started in Europe. So this idea was something that required a variety of different tactics over time. One of the early tactics was to inform a population, because the base population doesn't really necessarily understand what the dynamics are and what the impacts are. So there's a big, you know, sort of concerted effort, organized effort to change the narrative. And that's something, a big thing that we do in the coalition. We call that culture change, changing the culture through changing the narrative. So really grounding in values of justice and equity and democracy. How does this work in the framework of the best parts that we say that we are as a nation? So just like segregation, you know, how does segregation work in the framework of the who we think of ourselves as our best as a nation? How do those things measure up? And then really challenge the narrative to be consistent about demonstrating who we are in our actions and in our policy. So that's a big tactic. One of the things that we aim to do over time is to work for a constitutional amendment. So a constitutional amendment was the thing that was required to end slavery, and it was also the thing that was required to end segregation. And so we aim to do that here in the United States, and the magic number there is 38. You need 38 states to ratify an amendment like that. How do we then mobilize the populace within at least 38 states to understand well enough what the issues are to act on that at the time when we would ask for that, which is not now, because we don't have 38 states. So what we're doing is working at the state level to work on campaigns that are elevating the issues well enough for people to begin to understand what the issues are. We do that at the local and state level, also at the federal level, by accompanying Indigenous leaders especially land and water protectors, as they're pursuing their own self-determination. And we organize settler descended folks, especially people of Christian faith and people who are descended of Christian faith, those primary beneficiaries of the system. We organize them to support these indigenous-led movements. And we believe that by doing that, what we're doing is we are working for justice with our indigenous siblings. At the same time, we are changing the narrative at the local and state level. So those are a few of the tactics that we use.
The Mennonite Church, I know, has been one of the main kind of Christian organizations that, or faith-based organizations that are behind and involved with this work. Can you talk a little about that relationship? Why the Mennonites? Why did that denomination take this on as opposed to other, perhaps other denominations? How does that relate to just the Mennonite way of being?
Interesting. Well, I want to begin by saying that our coalition was established by three Mennonite women, myself and two Mennonite pastors from Ohio, actually. Both of them are from Ohio. One of them, Anita Amstutz, was pastoring in New Mexico at the time, and Sherry Hostetler was and continues to pastor in California and San Francisco. And so the three of us established this coalition originally to call on our faith institutions to accompany Indigenous people in seeking justice, and not also seeking justice for the earth itself. Because from my point of view, Indigenous justice is land justice, and land justice or environmental justice is Indigenous justice. And so as environmental pollution was reaching a peak in extraction, particularly in fracking in Ohio, I think that was an issue that was something that was especially a heart issue for these friends of mine that are from Ohio. We thought, gosh, how do we mobilize ordinary people to be a part of this? So beyond trying to take the route of diplomacy, which I had spent more than a decade doing, in institutions in the international arena and also here in this country, that was a hard learning curve. And what I learned is that everything that is happening, extraction on Indigenous people's lands, removal on Indigenous people's lands here and around the world, is legal. Like, it's embedded in our legal system. It's completely justified. It's justified legally. It's also justified theologically. We have to have a movement to change that. And so we thought, well, you know, that's going to take a while, so we better get started. And the first people that we approached, because they're our kin, people that we know and knew, were Mennonites and in the Mennonite context. But I want to be really clear, we have not to this date sought a resolution within the national church or asked for the national church to work at that sort of paper level. Instead, we have invited congregations, individuals, congregations, and conferences and regions to be a part of the work at local and national levels with our Indigenous siblings. So instead of having it sort of this abstract outside, you know, outside our worldview, instead sort of working concretely together in the movements for justice. So for example, we worked with the National Indian Child Welfare Association. They requested that we would organize folks to uphold the Indian Child Welfare Act. And that went to the Supreme Court in 2023. And so we organized churches across the country to file amicus briefs with the Supreme Court in support of the Indian Child Welfare Act. Up until that point, there had been only religious leaders had only filed briefs opposing it, asking for the dismantling of this key civil rights legislation. So the Indian Child Welfare Act acknowledges that tribes in the United States, Native American tribes, have the right to dictate where their children are going to be placed. That piece of legislation, which was passed by Congress in 1979, has been challenged more times than the Affordable Care Act. it's constantly being challenged. And so we organized a national network of people to uphold Indigenous sovereignty on behalf of Indigenous children. And so we've also worked with a variety of other movements at the national level in the judiciary, and then a variety of local movements with Indigenous leadership.
There's a variety of projects that your coalition has created and is doing. And I know one that I'd love for you to talk about, because I think it's unusual in one context anyway, is the Sacred Lands Playlist. Would you touch on what that is and how that works?
Yeah. So, and this is stepping back a moment too to talk a little bit about who we are and our structure. So I mentioned before that we're not really an organization, and that's true. Our primary human capacity comes from volunteers. And so we have a variety of working groups all across the country, many working groups where people form groups around work that they feel called to do. And so we say, well, you know, if it's consistent with our vision, let's support it. And as we were engaging in movement work around the Indian Child Welfare Act, around, you know, protecting the sacred land at Oak Flat in Arizona, the site of a copper mine, this land guaranteed by treaty to the San Carlos Apache has been traded by Congress. And so as we've been doing that work, we just thought, gosh, you know, we show up to these events and vigils and marches at times, and just kind of, what do we do? And so an organizer who was an amazing organizer, Doe Hoyer, they are now the director of our national campaigns, is also somebody who is a passionate singer in this movement that is sort of democratizing song. So at the community level. And so Doe said, why don't we form a working group and ask people who are musicians to contribute songs for the movement? And we thought, yeah, let's do that. That's a really important way of changing the narrative and drawing people into who we are and what we are. And so Doe and a variety of others came together and created that playlist, which is beautiful and fabulous. And now everywhere we go, we sing. And I love that. And that's also so consistent with the Mennonite tradition, although these are not traditional Mennonite hymns. They're land-based. They're hymns often about the land and seeking justice on the land. And Anne Doe themselves is not from the Mennonite tradition. So, but it kind of worked. It's like, yeah, this is a thing we want to do. And so it's been wonderful. In fact, you can hear from the way I've been sharing with you that I'm kind of a policy geek, and that's my wheelhouse. But our coalition has changed so much to accommodate the needs of our base and the way that we form community together. We recognize, gosh, in order for us to do this work, we have to form community, and music is a way that we do that. We now also have a chaplain, and we engage in worship together. We do decolonizing worship that is led by our chaplain, the Reverend Canon Debbie Royals, who's a Yaqui from Arizona, and she leads us in decolonizing worship on Fridays once a month. And we call it decolonizing worship because we recognize that we're figuring out how to do that. We can't say for sure that it's decolonized. Who knows? We were all brought up in this system, but we're working at it together and trying to discover together on the road what that might be like. So yeah, we engage in a lot of activities that are sort of adjacent to the policy work as we grow as a community. And anybody who has a good idea, we'll try it out.
Another, as I was looking at your webpage, another term that I'd love for you to explain and elucidate, as it were, is rematriation. And how, what that is, and how that fits into the work and just the perspective of your life.
You bet. So talking about rematriation in general, and then about how we embody that. Rematriation is about calling back to the original people, the lands that that have been lost. And so this is part of acknowledging, you know, the first mother, which is the earth, and calling back into the community lands that have been lost. And so we think of that as rematriation. That's the way many Indigenous leaders refer to land return. Land return is so important because sovereignty, Indigenous sovereignty, is really rooted in land and Indigenous communities' understanding of land and our own cultural and spiritual practices and relating to land. In my tradition, Tewa descendant, in my tradition, you know, land is kin. It's not separate. And that's common across many Indigenous communities in North America. But to get to the work of rematriation that we do, but once again, there was a volunteer and an activist, her name is Megan, who said, you know, I need to purchase a home for my father who's retired. And I know that that is on land that's ill-gotten. How do I contribute to land return by taxing myself when I'm engaging with land? And we thought, yeah, this person, Megan, who's relatively young, is not a person who controls significant wealth. This is not a person who has significant land. What's the process for contributing? How could we create a rematriation fund that is a lot of small contributors contributing to a big pot? Once again, democratizing that work, because a lot of land return work is done by people who have significant wealth or land. And so we said, well, you know, let's try and create sort of a fund that people can contribute to. And we're not a foundation. We're not asking for people to apply for these funds. Instead, why don't we work with the communities we're already working with? We have relationships with activists who are working for sovereignty. Let's go side by side and figure out what we can do together in terms of sort of backing up and giving some, you know, just some capacity to the lands, the desire for returning land for partners that we're in relationship with. And so we thought, well, you know, we're going to try and raise $20,000. $20,000, I don't know if you know, Barbara, the price of land, but it's, you're not going to buy anything with $20,000 really. But we thought, well, we could contribute to, you know, capital campaign, or, you know, there, we could join with others to maximize, you know, what we're able to do, and because we care about rematriation. And so I think we raised $100,000 in the first 2 months. There were a lot of people out there in our base who said, yeah, we want to participate in rematriation. And so we're in that process of learning, you know, it's a complex, there are a lot of complexities to dealing with land. And then the final thing I want to say about it is that rematriation, when it happens, happens in the context of a system of laws and policies that are oppressive. So we think about rematriation as, if you're looking at the movement to end slavery, the abolition movement, this is kind of like the Underground Railroad. You can take individuals and accompany them across the border for freedom, but that's not going to put an end to slavery. The only thing that's going to put an end to slavery is to change the law. So we say, yes, we are accompanying our partners in identifying, as they identify land, we're trying to partner to say, yes, we believe in that, and we want to enable that. And we recognize that does not bring an end to the oppression of Indigenous people. In order to do that, we have to change the law. So we're doing both of those things at the same time, just like the abolition movement did.
This conversation obviously is kind of skimming the top of a much deeper and complicated topic and action and system. But someone listening to this and maybe hearing about the doctrine and the legal system and your work and rematriation really for the first time, do you have a suggestion about what to do, where to go, what the next steps might be, or the first steps might be for them?
You bet. So our coalition, we know that changing structures, changing laws and policies is not something that can be done by individuals alone. And that is why we seek to build coalition and have built coalition with folks across the nation, across North America. Because we're in a culture that values individualism and individual action, we are sometimes blind to the impact of working together, when in fact, collective action is what's required to engage in this kind of work. And so what I would invite listeners to do, my neighbors, I live here in the Pacific Northwest, I would encourage you to come to our website, dismantlediscovery.org, and come to an orientation. Consider joining a working group. It's not as boring as it sounds. Actually, it's pretty awesome and entertaining. It's a way of meeting people in your own community and making friends with people across the country and sometimes across the world, and being engaged in work that is meaningful and long-term. And our volunteers, all these people who are doing this, thousands of people, have the opportunity to engage in our own ideas. How do we change the world? Well, there isn't an easy five-step plan to do that. It's going to take all of us working together. And so I really would invite people into working together. Of course, the coalition is not the only way to work together. There are lots of ways to do that. And we try to support as many as we can with human capacity. And so at the local level, the state level, and at the national level. And so we really are asking folks to divest from this belief that what we see on the news is all there is, and to invest in faith in each other. We have a future, we have security based on the relationships we have with each other. And it's so interesting, I interned this last summer from an elite school, actually, who said, you know, I've learned this year that everything is bad. It's only getting worse and there's nothing I can do about it. That's what I'm learning. That's what I hear. Everything's terrible. It's only getting worse and there's nothing I can do about it. And I said, well, there is something you can do about it. And that thing that we can do about it may feel small, but when we join our energy together, we have the capacity to change reality. I know it's true. I believe that's true. We've actually, you know, in support of Oak Flat, this is just one thing. You know, we started working to uphold the Indian Child Welfare Act. We got 33 Christian organizations to file briefs with the court, the Supreme Court. And that was phenomenal. No Christian organization had ever done that. And we got 33. When we started working with in the case at Oak Flat that also went to the Supreme Court, we got more than 100 Christian organizations to work and support, not just Christian, other denominations as well, and 5 Christian denominations. So we started out with one ask, it was 33, now we're over 105 denominations, including the 5 large, well, some of, I would say 3 of the largest denominations in the United States, filed briefs with the court in support of religious freedom for Apache Stronghold at Oak Flat. So even over the small time that we've been in existence in the past 11 years, we've seen this change in narrative that is actually leading to a change in position, a change in the way we see ourselves at the community level, and a change in the world that we can measure. So if you're interested in getting involved, we want you, we need you. I also want to point out that in the coalition, we really often say, we're not asking for your money. We want your heart. We're not asking you to write a check. But if that's all you can do, of course, we're not going to say no, but we want your heart. We want your life. Join us. We want you. We need you.
Maybe your heart and your money.
No, we really don't ask for money. We really don't.
No, I know.
Because what we need is human capacity. Right. And when people give us money, what we do with it is we pay wages for human capacity.
What inspires you to keep doing this work?
Well, thank you for asking that question. I'll give you 2 brief answers. The first is that, you know, I myself am Tewa and grew up in poverty and chaos and violence, which is common among Indigenous people in an urban area in a major city. And 70% of us live in cities now. But anyway, I met a holy man this last year, Jonathan Oldhorse. He's Ogallala. And he taught me this prayer. My people want to live. At the end of the day, that's the prayer I say every single morning. And that's my motivation. You know, my people want to live. And it sounds dramatic, but the fact is, we have the largest empire the world has ever known that has made it its policy directive to annihilate my people from the surface of the earth. And so dismantling this system of oppression is what's required for us to survive and to exist with human dignity. At the same time, I am a Christian and I am a Mennonite, both of those things. You don't have to be either to be part of our coalition, but I am both. And I just recall how in Luke chapter 4, Jesus, it's the beginning of his ministry, and he is naming his mandate. And he says, the Spirit of God has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. And he says what that is: release for the captive, return of sight to the blind, freedom for the oppressed. And the announcement of Jubilee, which is the just reordering of human systems, which is where the original inhabitants of land, that land is returned to them and debts are forgiven, captives are released. From my point of view, that's embodying that is what I must do if I actually believe what I say I believe. You know, if that's the mandate of Jesus and I claim to be a follower of Jesus, that's my mandate. And so I feel animated by that. And I have to say, this work is challenging. It's hard. It's kind of going against the grain. It's countercultural, but it's so joyful and fulfilling working with Indigenous leadership and with people who are settler descended and Christian descended and Christians. The transformation that is possible and occurs in community is profound. And it's amazing to be part of that.
Thank you so much, Sarah Augustine, for talking about this work that you're doing and a call to action. So I really appreciate your time and insights.
Thank you, Barbara. It's been a joy to talk with you.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.